Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path Morning Edition. My name is Steve Gregg. We are live from 9:30 to 10 every weekday morning, and as such, we make ourselves available to you to call in if you have questions about the Bible that you're wondering about and or questions about your Christian life, and you'd like to bring them up and possibly get them answered. I say possibly get them answered because obviously I can't pretend to know all the answers, and I don't know that I can answer all your questions, but I will do my best. And there's a good chance that the questions you have may fall within the range of things that I have studied and know something about, I hope. And if I don't, we have another option, and that is that we have a large audience out there, some of whom might know the right answer if I don't. So if you think I've given the wrong answer, if you disagree with something I share with the caller, feel free to call and bring correction or balance. The number to call if you'd like to be on the program is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Our first caller today is Ben, calling from Dexter, Oregon. Ben, good to hear from you this morning. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good, Steve. A long time ago, not that long ago, but I listened to your church history series. It was really good on your website. But there was one particular story that I just remember the vaguest details about. I didn't know if maybe you had remembered it and could tell me about it, because going through that series and trying to find it...
Well, it's only 30 lectures. You should be able to find it easy.
Yeah, with an hour and a half each, right? But it was really good. But it was there was two people that had a conflict, a Christian and another person, and the other person ended up getting in trouble with the law or something, and then the Christian came and testified on his behalf, even though they were kind of enemies. Does that sound familiar at all?
Well, in principle, it sounds like another story. It's not exact. None of the details sound the same, but I think you might be thinking of a famous story from the history of the Anabaptist movement, which is like the Mennonites. And and that is that when it was illegal to be an Anabaptist in Europe, when they were being persecuted by the state, there was a time when an officer of the law was pursuing to arrest a Christian man, an Anabaptist man. And the man, the Christian, passed over a frozen lake successfully and got to the other side to safety. But as the pursuer was coming across the lake, he fell through the ice and was going to die, would have died. And he called out for help. And the Christian, who now had, you know, a great opportunity to escape and save his life, instead turned back and he rescued the officer, who then took him, arrested him, took him and had him executed. That would be the closest I can think of to what you're describing. If there is another story like that, I've forgotten it.
Okay, well, I really appreciate it, Steve, and I would recommend anybody listening through that series. I actually have been listening to some college church history courses online, and I still think that yours is way better. So I really appreciate it, and hopefully other people will check it out. All right,
okay,
I'll talk to you later.
Appreciate you saying so. God bless you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. We have our lines open if you'd like to call. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and the number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Ben was talking about the church history lectures that can be found at my website. There are 30 lectures that I gave some years ago on the history of the church. And I get a lot of comments about them. I get a lot of people who say it's been helpful to them. Maybe it'd be helpful to you if you're not very familiar with the history of the Christian movement from the time of Christ to the present and how we got here from where we started out. That series might be helpful to you. And it's one of many lecture series that you can listen to for free or download for free from my website. There are about 900 MP3 files at my website that you can access for free. Download them, put them on your iPod, or listen to them right on your computer if you prefer. And the set called Church History, or the History of the Church, is just 30 of those lectures. There are hundreds and hundreds more on other topics as well. And these are all free resources. There's nothing that we will sell you at our website. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com, just like the name of the radio program, thenarrowpath.com. We have a very unusual situation in that we don't have any calls waiting, and that's we've almost never had that situation. So perhaps you have something you'd like to ask, feel free to call me, 1-800-227-5278. Here's a question that was written in. Somebody wanted to know, is gambling a sin? Well, I would define sin as something that God has forbidden. And there's nothing in the Bible that specifically names gambling as a forbidden activity. However, of course, much gambling, perhaps most gambling, may violate certain scriptural principles. Perhaps not all gambling does. For example, a bunch of ladies who get together to play bridge, or someone who plays poker with their friends for pennies or for nothing, just for fun. I don't think we could say that that's a sin, because I don't know of any biblical principle that would be violated by that kind of activity. Of course, most people who gamble, I suppose we could say most, at least we think of gambling as that kind of thing that goes on when people go to Las Vegas and lose a lot of money or try to gain a lot of money. And that, I would think, would fall under certain biblical principles that aren't directly related to gambling. For example, the Bible indicates that the money that we have is God's money, and therefore we are supposed to be wise stewards of God's money, and we will have to give an account someday for what we did with His money. Now, if somebody thinks that they can increase God's money for God's sake by gambling, I think they're probably not thinking in biblical categories. The Bible indicates that the right way to earn money is to work for it. And actually, the Bible indicates that easily gained wealth can be a corrupting thing. As we know from, for example, people who have won the lottery, there's been a lot of follow-up on some of these people who have won the lottery, and it's, in many cases, ruined their lives. Jesus said, it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God than for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. And that being so, it would seem that somebody who's trying to be rich has got some kind of motivation different than what Jesus would inspire. Jesus does not indicate that it's an advantage to be rich. And Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 6 that those who want to be rich fall into much temptation and a snare and many hurtful lusts that drown men's souls in perdition and destruction. Sounds kind of negative. Those who want to be rich, he said. So I guess I'd have to say, if you go someplace to gamble for money and hope to gain a lot of money, what is your motivation? It would seem to be that you want easy riches. What else would you do it for? If that is the motivation, then I would say there's some sin in that. Then there's more, because gambling for many people becomes a dominating habit, what some people would refer to as an addiction, a bondage in the life. And Paul indicated that even if an activity itself was innocent, it is not desirable to become in bondage to it. When he was talking about eating meat sacrificed to idols and what a Christian might or might not allow himself to eat, he said, all things are lawful to me. He means all kinds of food are lawful. But he said, I will not be brought into bondage of any. And so even if we could argue that gambling can be an innocent activity, if a person is prone to become in bondage to it, then it'd be something to avoid. That is, there are a number of things to consider about gambling. We can't just say the Bible says gambling is a sin, because it doesn't. But we can say that the motives that lead people to gamble could be very much the wrong motives. And in most cases, it would seem they are. Unless, of course, you're just gambling for pennies or something and not really interested in the money. So it seems to me that a desire to be rich is what motivates a lot of people to gamble, at least with large stakes. And that would be that'd be a non-Christian motive. It leads you to destruction, Paul said. So I would say, without being able to say that gambling is itself a sin, I would say that if a person is somebody who does gamble, they need to look at their motives and say, am I really doing this for the glory of God? Am I doing something that is the best stewardship, the best way that God's money can be used? Am I doing this with the motive to get rich? Do I tend to get in bondage to this behavior? Once I start, do I find it easy to stop? Those are all questions a Christian should ask himself, because even when you have liberty, you should not be brought into bondage to anything. So, you know, it's a complicated question. It's, you know, if you say, yes, it's wrong to gamble, then you're condemning a whole lot of innocent stuff that goes on in, you know, living rooms that doesn't have a lot of money involved. It's just a good time being had by all. But on the other hand, if you're gambling in a way that is motivated by greed or some other low motive, then I'd say that's not appropriate for Christians. And what's not appropriate is the greed. What's not appropriate is the motivation there. Let's talk to John from Vallejo, California. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you very much. Appreciate your... Maybe you can comment
yes.
on or... Yeah, I'm King Solomon. God blessed that guy so much, gave him wisdom and everything. And I'm having a tough time because, you know, here's a guy who, you know, at the end of the day had, what, 300 wives and 700 concubines?
The reverse, and, 700 wives, 300 concubines, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, to me, how can this guy be considered the wisest man of all time when his life ended so poorly? Like I said,
well, it shows that if you are given a gift by God, you can certainly mismanage it and cease to benefit from it. God did give him wisdom. The wisdom that God gave him was the wisdom of a ruler to manage a kingdom. See, when God appeared to him as a young man, when he first became king, God said, ask anything you want from me. And he said, well, you know, the people are a multitude. I need wisdom. I need discretion to be able to rule them well. And God said, okay, I'm going to give you that. And so God gave him some discretion in that area. And he had a lot of wisdom, like, you know, to see the right course to do things and so forth. That's what wisdom is. But as he himself said in the Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And that being so, you have the problem of him getting to a place where he wasn't fearing the Lord anymore. And if you don't have the fear of the Lord, that's the foundation of wisdom. I believe he lost his wisdom. Or if he didn't lose it, he neglected it, and he began to act foolishly because rather than fearing God, he began to have other things that motivated him. So if a person fears the Lord, as he did initially, that person is capable of being very wise. But if a person compromises their relationship with God, well, that wisdom ceases to be of any value to them. In fact, it tends to dissipate. You know, the Bible says that he married an Egyptian wife, the Pharaoh's daughter, and he built a shrine for her and for her gods. And also he married other foreign women, and he built shrines for their gods. Well, that was something he did to keep his wives happy. But he's not the first man who kind of compromised his spiritual life to keep his wife happy. It's not a good idea. Adam did that too, by the way. And so did Abraham when he went into Hagar. That was to keep his wife happy. I suppose there's sometimes very few things that will motivate us to do the wrong thing as much as trying to keep somebody happy who's close to us, including a wife or something like that. And I think that was his mistake. Once he did that, he put other considerations ahead of God. And once God was no longer his primary focus and reverence, then his wisdom, I think, departed from him. That's my thought. Let's talk to Trilby from San Bernardino, California. Hello, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello. I have a question regarding Lazarus. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, when Mary came to him weeping, and then Jesus groaned in the spirit and was troubled. And he asked where he had been laid, and then the Lord came to see, and Jesus wept. My question is, was he troubled because the Jews came with Mary, or that she even came at all, or what troubled him to weep when he knew he was going to raise him?
Well, I believe that what troubled Jesus in his spirit was seeing the grief that his friends had. Jesus, I think, was sympathetic toward their grief. And at the tomb where he wept, you know, some people think that he was weeping because people didn't have enough faith, but the Bible doesn't say that's why he did. And you're right, he knew he was going to raise Lazarus from the dead, so he wasn't just weeping at the loss of Lazarus. I'll tell you what my impression is, and I've always had this impression, and that is that Jesus, as he stood at the tomb of his friend, it just swept over Jesus like an emotional wave, how horrible death is, as he saw the sisters of Lazarus weeping and all the people sorrowing, and I think he just was sympathetic toward the sorrow of these people. And even though he was going to raise Lazarus from the dead, just knowing Lazarus was dead and seeing this reaction, I think brought to Jesus thoughts, just the whole tragedy that the fall had brought. And, you know, that even though this man was going to be raised from the dead, all over the world there were people weeping like these people, and they weren't going to have their brother raised from the dead immediately. And that I think he was just face to face with the phenomenon of death in such a way that I think he found it rather overwhelming, out of sympathy for the plight that sin had brought upon mankind. And I think that's what caused him to be so emotional about it. Now, I can't be sure that I'm right because I'm not inside of his head.
And
there could have been something else going on there. But as I've read that, the mentions of him groaning in his spirit, being troubled in his spirit, and the mention of him weeping is generally connected with him seeing the other people weeping. And I personally think that it was, that he was sympathizing with them. And not just with them, since he knew that they were going to have their brother restored to them and they'd be happy as can be, but rather these people suffering the loss of a loved one were simply a small microcosm of what goes on the world over and the great suffering that comes on mankind because of death and because of sin. And I think that he was, he might well have been reflecting on how things were before the fall and how it might have been, but this is the way it is right now. And it was a great tragedy, certainly something to weep about. Paul says we should weep with those who weep, and that is to be, that we feel true sympathy for them. And I think that he is a good example of that himself.
Thank you so much, because I was thinking the other way, that he was thinking, why do you doubt me, type thing. Don't you believe? But it makes more sense with what you're saying.
Well, I'm not sure that your way is wrong. I'm not sure that your way is wrong, but I think this is how I think about it. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
All right.
You have
Thanks
a blessed
people.
Day.
God bless you. You too. Okay. We're going to talk next to James from San Jose, California. James, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
All right. Thank you for taking my call. I'm kind of switching gears here, less biblical and more about a certain pastor, Pastor Francis Chan in Southern California. Are you familiar with him and the doctrine that he preaches at all?
I can't say I'm familiar with the doctrine that he preaches because I've only heard him maybe once or twice on a YouTube video. I don't have a TV or anything, so I don't know if he's even on TV, but I've had very limited exposure to him. I just heard somebody tell me yesterday that he left the pastorate to go like to Egypt or something like that. I don't even know if that's
right.
True. But I don't know what doctrine he's specifically known for.
Right, and I'm just trying to see, is he along the lines of the charismatics or not? And because I'm curious myself. I try to stay away from those.
Well, so, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know. But have you heard him very much?
I've heard a few sermons. I'm new to my faith. I've heard a few things, but again, on the YouTube, and some of the things sounded good. But again, I like to do some research before I start reading books about people following their beliefs.
Yeah, all I can say is that my exposure to him is extremely limited. But I didn't have any objection. I didn't have any objection to what I heard from him. I would add to that, I'd add that I've heard a few people I know talk about him, and it's always been favorable. Now, whether there's something objectionable in his doctrine or not, I have not heard. There could be, but I'm not aware of it. So I'm going to give him a clean bill of health insofar as my knowledge goes.
Can I ask you one question?
Okay.
Last question?
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the contemporary movement that's been going on? I go to a church, and we have two services. One's traditional, one's contemporary. And I attend, personally, the traditional one. I hold God in high reverence. And I just kind of feel that some of these contemporary services don't hold the same reverence for God.
Okay.
Do you see that in the church today?
I'll say this. I don't have anything against being contemporary per se, but I would have to agree that some things that characterize some contemporary worship services have struck me as shallow and not very reverent. Now, I say some because it is impossible to broad brush this. I mean, there are some congregations that use contemporary music, for example, instead of the hymns. Which do not compromise their message, and the music they choose is worshipful and reverent and so forth. But I will also say that as I have gone to many modern churches, a lot of times the contemporary services have not struck me as being as reverent or anything other than shallow as I would like them to see. I'd like to see them be. On the other hand, you know, a traditional service isn't always, you know, that weighty either. I mean, it's the elements that make going to church valuable to you spiritually would be whether you are being fed the Word of God in an uncompromising way, whether the worship there is something that really elevates your spirit to God genuinely, and, of course, whether the fellowship you have with the saints is something that is glorifying to God. And I think you'll find some of that in some contemporary churches, and you'll find some of that in some traditional churches. But I think you'll also go to some traditional churches and some contemporary churches and find very little of those things. It's not. I don't think the line is really between contemporary and traditional. I think it's a difference in the spiritual quality of the people who are worshiping and the people who are, you know, I guess directing the services. But yes, I know what you feel. I've been to a lot of contemporary services that I had the same impression about that you're talking about, that they were pretty shallow.
Okay. Yeah. It's, you know, and in my church, you know, it's the same leaders and the same elders, and they all have a high reverence for God. It's just the differences in the approach to preaching the gospel just kind of strikes me. So,
yeah.
But,
well, you know what? I think the contemporary mode, in some cases, can make a pure and uncompromised message palatable in to a generation that would not even, you know, be attracted, I suppose, to a more traditional service. But the problem is, many times people are not really, they don't even know what they're looking for in church. They don't even know what church is supposed to give them, and what they're getting is an emotional uplift from, you know, from well performed music, and and an inspiring lecture which they interpret as a sermon because it's generally about a religious subject. But they leave feeling somewhat uplifted by music and by a talk that they received, but they don't know whether or not it's truly spiritual and bringing them in touch with God, because they don't know how to determine that. They've never seen anything like that. I mean, to tell you the truth, a lot of churches today are, I guess, modeled after pep rallies, more or less. And a lot of times the worship is led by a concert-type band. And I'm not saying they shouldn't. You know, when I go to one of these services and the band is playing through loud amplifiers and things like that, I'll sit and listen. But a lot of times if I try to sing, I can't hear my own voice, even though, you know, it's coming out of my mouth 6 inches from my ear. I can't hear myself, and I certainly can't hear the congregation sing. I might as well be alone listening to a record with headphones. And so, to me, a lot of times it's like going to a concert and being entertained, or maybe not even entertained. Maybe it is ministering something. It could be that it's ministering something spiritual, but it's not the same thing as what I consider to be corporate worship. Anyway, that's me. Everyone's going to have a different reaction to different styles, and I think the main thing every person has to ask themselves is, by my going to church, by my going to this church and this service, am I seeing in my life a development into a more Christ-like behavior day by day? Am I being transformed into the image of Christ, drawing nearer to God, having a more genuine relationship and fellowship with God, not just while I'm at church, but at all times? Is my life improving because of what I'm getting on Sunday morning? If the answer is yes, then I would think that it may be a good thing, even if it doesn't appeal to some other people.
Sure. Thank you very much. Very insightful. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, James. Good talking to you. Let's talk to, Bill from Modesto, California. Bill, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you. The Calvinists and the Catholics, do you think they're preaching a different Jesus than how Calvinists believe that Jesus only saved a few? And the Catholics believe that Jesus didn't pay the whole man's sin on the cross? Is that a different Jesus they're preaching?
Well, Catholics and Calvinists don't have that much in common with each other. They definitely, both of them have their differences from what I consider to be historic Christianity. Calvinism arose around the year 400 with a man named Augustine. Before that, the doctrines that we call Calvinism did not exist in the church. They existed in a group that were viewed by the church as heretics, but they didn't exist in the church. You can read the church fathers about that. In the first four centuries, the church fathers, they knew about some of the doctrines which later became part of Calvinism, and they would talk about them, but they considered them to be part of a cultic heresy, and they believed that this idea of total predestination and so forth was something that didn't make biblical sense to them. Is it a different Jesus? I don't know. I don't know if they have a different Jesus or just a different perception of the same Jesus. I believe that we want to know Jesus as he really is, and therefore, if we have wrong views of Jesus, it's damaging. But it may not be that we're really guilty of a different Jesus. It may be that we got the same Jesus, but we need to get to know him better, and we misunderstand him in some ways. That is at least the more gracious way to look at people we disagree with, and it may be the correct way to look at it sometimes. It's hard to make that judgment, but I appreciate your call, and I'd talk more about it if I wasn't out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. You can find out more about us at www.thenarrowpath.com. I'm Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend.